Thank you very much. My name is Jim Bopp. I represent Plaintiff Wisconsin Right to Life. One of the central issues in this case is the application of the recent Hartigan decision by this court to the challenges that are mounted to the Wisconsin campaign finance statutes. There were two aspects to the Hartigan case, as there are here.
Madigan, I think you mean?
Madigan. Madigan. You're right. I'm sorry.
Illinois.
Huh?
Not from Illinois.
Yes, not from Illinois, and a familiar name as well. But sorry about that. There were two aspects. One is the vagueness of certain phrases in the Wisconsin statute. Similarly, there was a challenge to the vagueness of certain Illinois provisions. None of the Illinois provisions are ones that are challenged in Wisconsin. So other than the general principle that the First Amendment requires clarity in terms of what speech is regulated, Madigan does not control the outcome here. Second is the question of determination of when an organization is a PAC. That was extensively discussed in Madigan. Both the decision in Madigan is both distinguishable in certain aspects, but also in other aspects supports finding that as to Wisconsin Right to Life, since its major purpose is not a political activity, that it cannot be deemed to be a PAC.
Does Illinois have sort of a two-tier PAC system? I think Wisconsin does not. In other words, there's one set of reporting, registration and reporting requirements for major purpose PACs and another for non-major purpose PACs. Wisconsin, I think, lumps them all together, is to the extent that I can understand this statutory scheme.
Yes,
I think they're all lumped together. And I think that was true in Madigan as well.
I think you might be thinking of the Minnesota statute in the recent MCCL case. They expressly had two sets of provisions, one for organizations whose major purpose, they called those PACs. The others were for organizations that their major purpose was not political activity, and they called those political funds.
Right, and that may or may not make a difference in applying the rule from Buckley, because if the disclosure requirements for this separate category of non-major purpose PACs are not onerous, then they might survive, whereas if it's a full-blown PAC set of requirements, absent the contribution limits, because those are no longer viable after Citizens United, then we might have a different set of questions.
Mm-hmm. And we have full-blown PAC requirements in Wisconsin. Not only the requirement of registration, record-keeping, and periodic reporting, but also the requirement that that there is contribution limits to PACs and that there are source bans to PACs. These are the five features of the federal PACs that existed in Buckley and Mass Citizens when the court adopted the major purpose test.
But by contribution limits, those are no longer constitutional to the extent that they apply to independent expenditure organizations.
Yes, and we do have a PAC that has brought suit here that is an IE PAC, independent expenditure only PAC, and contribution limits aren't applicable to it. That's true. But if we consider Wisconsin Right to Life itself a PAC,
right.
Wisconsin Right to Life currently could do independent expenditures as a corporation, but is prohibited from making contributions. But if it itself became a PAC, it would make contributions as well. In other words, it has a contribution limit only PAC, as well as an independent expenditure PAC. And if it itself was a PAC, then it would make contributions as well. So it would not be exempt from the contribution limit since it would make contributions. Similarly, the corporate ban would still apply. So
would there be limits on the contributions it could receive?
There would be limits on, yes, contribution limits. There are contribution limits to PACs. So Wisconsin Right to Life would have such a limit under Wisconsin law.
So if the organization itself is construed as a PAC under these statutes and rules, then what it can accept as contributions are subject to limits applicable to PACs, which are what, something $3,000 a person per year, something like that?
$3,000.
So we do have full-blown PAC burdens
in
Wisconsin. The Buckley sense in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Madigan recognized when they this very point when they said when regulation as a political committee it entails adherence to these and more burdensome requirements, these other two, then there is more room to argue that the major purpose.
Well, what is the? I found your brief extremely difficult to follow. So tell me, what is the feature of the Wisconsin law that you regard as most harmful to your organization?
In this, regarding the PAC requirement, is that they?
You have an appeal. You're challenging a whole bunch of provisions. Now I'm asking you which provision that you're challenging is the most onerous.
Requiring the organization to be a PAC, because they'd have to comply with full PAC requirements that the Supreme Court and Citizens United said, even as to the first three, were onerous and burdensome and unconstitutional and required strict scrutiny to impose. But when you add the other two.
I didn't even understand that. I thought you were. What provision is it that made you a PAC that you're attacking?
There are three or four definitions of what a PAC is, both in the statutes and in the regulations impose PAC burdens.
What are you questioning? I don't understand.
And Citizens United condemned.
It's really hard to figure out what you were arguing in your brief. You have the shortest summary of argument I've ever seen. So can you point to a specific provision in the law that you think is unconstitutional?
Yes, certainly. The definition of PAC contained in 11.01, subsection 4, committee or political committee.
Okay, what does it say?
I'm reading it. Political committee or political committee means any person other than an individual and any combination of two or more persons, permanently or temporarily, which makes or accepts contributions or makes disbursements, whether or not the activities engaged in or which are exclusively political, except that a committee does not include a political group. In other words, they and the definition of expenditure reveals and also political purpose reveals that what the communications you have to be doing is to influence an election. There is no threshold here, but there is a threshold for registration, but there is no major purpose.
I don't understand. Now, what is wrong with this, or why don't you...
Political committee, because you spend a small amount of money to put one political ad in the newspaper, even though the organization is a multimillion-dollar organization. So you spend $500 on a political ad.
So to be constitutional, how would the definition have to be altered?
It would say, and the major purpose of the organization is the election or nomination of candidates.
There's actually that language in one of the exemptions, and this is the argument, as I understand it, is really a function of the definitions by which a political spender, a political speaker, is probably a better way to refer to it, is deemed a PAC and therefore subject to the registration and reporting requirements in the statutory and regulatory scheme. And that's a function of several different definitions. You cited one. It's the definition of committee, which cross-references or encompasses the definition of contribution and disbursement, which contains the political purpose requirement, which tracks the Buckley language about influencing an election, which was overbroad in Buckley, and that's where the limitation having to do with
the major purpose
came from, but the major purpose limitation is built into one of the statutory exceptions that the Wisconsin legislature adopted in the wake of Buckley. I can't remember when, but it's there. And curiously, nobody has mentioned it in this litigation. It's in the section of the statute that pertains to registration and reporting requirements, section 1105 and 06. 1105 sub 11 says that you're exempt from the registration requirement if you're exempt from reporting under 1106.2, and under 1106.2 you're exempt from reporting if you're not primarily organized for a political purpose.
Primarily is not the major purpose test.
This may be Wisconsin's effort to get there.
Well, maybe, but it's inadequate. And in fact, that question has been reviewed by several circuits on whether or not a group's, quote, primary purpose satisfies the major purpose test. The answer is no.
Wait, what's the difference between primary purpose and major purpose?
You can only have one major purpose. You can have multiple primary purposes. That's why. Because it can be...
Well, you can use that's not true. You can say a major purpose of something is X, right? That's English.
The court has been using the major purpose to make sure that we don't misunderstand that it's only one major purpose, and then when they discuss in Mass Citizens, they say there's two tests. One, what is your central organizational purpose? It can only be one central organization.
What if you don't have? What if you have three primary purposes, all of equal significance?
Then it wouldn't be your major purpose to do politics. If it's just one primary purpose and you have three,
escapes regulation.
No, you can be the court. It's perfectly constitutional to require event-driven reports. In other words, you put that ad in the paper, then you have to file a report about that ad. How you spent $500 on, you know, to New York Times on an ad, and Joe Blow gave you $500 to fund the ad. These are one-time event-driven reports, and you can do that. That's perfectly constitutional. You just can't make this organization spends $500 and has $1 million budget. You can't require it to be regulated, comprehensively regulated as a PAC, where you report every single donor of the $1 million, even though not 999 et cetera thousand had nothing to do with politics.
Part of the problem, however, is that in the Madigan case, this court did say that this major purpose requirement is not of constitutional import. It's just a question of statutory interpretation.
You could interpret what they said that way, but they gave four reasons, and I addressed one, which is where the regulations are more comprehensive, then you have a greater justification. That's the first one.
So is what you're really complaining about is the reporting requirements that are imposed on you?
No. There are five requirements imposed on us if we're a PAC.
You are complaining about the reporting requirements, aren't you, or not?
One of them, yes. But there are five, and we complain about every one of them.
Just the 24-hour one, or...? What do you mean?
Yes, that's a separate challenge to another statute that involves...
Is that the only reporting requirement you...
A specific challenge, yes, is doing the report in 24 hours rather than in a reasonable time or 72 hours or something.
No, but I find that one of your weak arguments because, look, this is the last 15 days before the election, right? Well... In 15 days before the election, if you want actually to provide notice to the voters about what the organization is doing in the political campaign, it has to be done very, very rapidly, right? If you send, now you want to do it by certified mail, if you send certified mail 2 days before the election, it's very unlikely to actually arrive in time, right?
Well, we're not saying certified mail is a constitutional requirement. But
what's your alternative to the 24-hour reporting requirement?
48 hours or 72 hours. It makes a big difference when an organization has
to
do
72 hours, that's already 3 days, which means nothing you do in the last 3 days of the election would be reported to the... Why can't you do it within 24 hours, send an email or something, right? What's the big deal?
I don't know anybody that requires...
What is the big deal in sending notice within 24 hours? Just an email, right?
Is the staff that it requires...
What's the staff required? You just have it set up. You wouldn't even have a staff.
Hey, look, I represent a lot of organizations. I know how difficult this is for them, particularly if they're active at all. Tracking, getting from the vendor the information about how much the ad was.
If you're making a contribution, it's on your computer, X dollars to...
No, we're making an expenditure of an independent expenditure. We're not making a contribution.
Whatever you're making expenditure. Every expenditure you make is on your computer.
No,
right? No. What, you write checks by hand or something?
No, because it isn't triggered by checks. It's triggered. You place an ad in the paper. You may not have to pay in advance. You do it through a vendor. You've got to collect all that information in order to make the report. So it's not as simple as you say.
Collect what information?
How much the ad was. When was it placed? What was the date that it began? The information that's required in the report. So it is true that it would be simple if you had a small organization doing just one thing that wrote out the ad themselves,
the large
took it to the paper.
Large organizations can do more than small ones.
Huh? Well, yeah, it is because they don't have the sophistication. But even organizations, what we're talking about is not the sophistication to know what the law requires, but the simple administrative burden, and to do it in such an arbitrary and short time frame. Tenth Circuit thought that was unconstitutional.
Can you do it in 24 hours?
Can you?
Yes.
Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't.
The Wisconsin Government Accountability Board now has electronic filing for PAC filers, as I understand it.
Yes.
So you can do this, just upload these reports.
Which is good.
If you're a required PAC filer.
Yes.
Does this cover contributions, large contributions in the last 15 days as well, or just expenditures?
Expenditures.
Okay.
It's a lot different between making or receiving a contribution, and because you have the information, as you suggested, the information right there.
Well, yes and no.
The
requirements include... For contributions over $100, you have to report the occupation of the contributor.
Yes.
And list an address for the occupation as well as a personal address. So if you get a personal check, and I've done this. I've been a candidate for public office in Wisconsin, so I know how difficult this is. You sometimes have to double back with the contributor to find out what the occupation is if you don't know the contributor, and that takes time.
You have to make your best efforts to get that information. And if you don't, you're liable. And to make those best efforts to do that part of it, can involve a lot of activity by the organization.
But the 24-hour requirement does not apply to contributions, only to disbursements.
Right.
Okay.
Only to what?
Only to disbursements.
Okay, so what do you have to report about a disbursement?
You have to report who you paid, it was.
That's easy. What next?
What it was for.
That's obviously.
How much it was.
That you know.
Well, no, you don't necessarily know any of that.
We don't know any? You don't? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
You don't know who you made the disbursement to?
Well, campaigns, for instance, when they do radio ads, they don't... an organization that does a radio campaign does not select the radio stations that they're going to run their ads in.
You buy time to a media buyer.
Yeah, so you have to get that information.
Wait a second, but do they require you to... That's why I asked you what information they require. Now, one is who you gave the money to. Okay, that's the media buyer.
No, it's the stations. the stations, because all they were, your agent is the media buyer. The station is the one that you're paying.
The buyer reserves the time.
Yeah. And so then how much depends upon how many ads they're committing to run, and that varies from station to station. So, and their rates vary from station to station. And all of this is being handled by a media buyer, and all you know is usually the general, you know what the ad says, and you know what the kind of gross amount you're prepared to spend. They then go around and place these, and then it's that information you're supposed to report within 24 hours, and you as the organization don't have possession of any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to get it, okay? And they have to get it from someone. So there's a two-step process. They get it from they have to get it from the radio station, and then once they get it, they have to convey it to you. So it's two steps of, it can be very a lot of information.
If I could ask a question about,
so it just seems, you know, it's just artificial to say 24 hours. And if it's an informational interest, it is true, you know, the sooner the better, but not, you know, an hour from now is why is that needed, you know?
I have a question about your challenge to the oath requirement for independent expenditures, that you have to have on file an oath that says you haven't coordinated with whatever campaign you're running ads in favor of or in opposition to his or her candidacy. The regulation that the GAB adopted goes beyond what the statutory requirement for the oath is, as I understand it, and creates a sort of a presumption, or what I read as a presumption, that any expenditure is a contribution unless it's accompanied by this oath. And so if an independent expenditure group wrongly guesses that it isn't covered by the PAC rules and doesn't have to have the oath on file, everything it spends is construed as a contribution.
Which can trigger various criminal penalties.
Well, right, for the organization, but also for the candidate. Yeah, and that is what concerned me here.
Right. For having accepted a contribution and not reporting it.
Right.
And it could be in excess of the limits on contributions that the candidate can receive. Another criminal violation by the candidate.
Right. So it seems to me there's a significant burden on independent political speakers and candidates as well in the expansion of the oath that the GAB promulgated in that rule.
Yes, and all separate from what, you know, is what you can require constitutionally. If something, in fact, is coordinated, it can be deemed to be a contribution. But can something be deemed to be a contribution because you didn't file an oath? See, I mean, that's, you know, filing an oath is regardless of the facts. And the other problem with the oath, of course, under the statute, is you have to be anticipatory. You have to keep trying to figure out who you might be doing independent expenditures for, and you have to keep filing updates, you know, when you think that you might be doing that.
Just ask you a question, if I could take you back to the influencing language again. Do you think we would be aided by a possible certification to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to get a narrowing construction of that?
Well, this court did that in the BAPAC decision, certified to the Indiana Supreme Court. The influence language, they narrowly construed it. Certainly based on that precedent, you could do that, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Bond.
You.
Mr. Kosky?
May it please the court. Clay Kosky appearing on behalf of the appellees. I have three main points I'd like to make this morning, although there are many claims at issue in this case. The first is that the challenge language in Wisconsin law is not unconstitutionally vague. The Supreme Court's precedents in Buckley, McConnell, Wisconsin Right to Life 2, and Citizens United control on the question of vagueness, as does this court's recent decision in Madigan.
Well, what about this point that Mr. Bopp was making about the infeasibility or heavy burden of trying to report these disbursements within 24 hours in this 15-day period?
I would disagree that it is infeasible. As Judge Sykes pointed out, this can now be done online. It can be done simply through the Government Accountability Board's Campaign Finance Information System website. So both Wisconsin Right to Life and its PAC have the ability to register through that website and make 24-hour reports. And I'd like to correct something that Mr. Bopp said. It's both expenditures, so disbursements under Wisconsin law, and contributions that must be reported. Over $500 for contributions and over $20 or $25 for disbursements within 15 days of an election. So my position and the state's position is that...
In 24 hours?
In 24 hours.
How is that not significantly burdensome?
Because it can be accomplished electronically through the...
Well,
what
does
that
mean
exactly?
What is it that this
electronic system reports to...
Well, you can report by filling in a form, basically, an electronic form, the name, the address, and the other required information that's in 11.06.
So if you register, if Wisconsin Right to Life registers on this electronic information system, what does it get?
What does Wisconsin Right to Life get?
Right. What does it get when it clicks on the icon for this information?
My understanding of it is that it creates a login for you that you can use then to access your reporting information, and that you would simply log in like you're logging into an email account.
This concrete example, you deal with a media buyer. The media buyer goes out and finds some radio stations, and eventually, of course, it tells you what and sends you a bill and so on. But how is that information circuit abbreviated through the electronic system?
Well, the electronic system doesn't help you find the information you need. That's correct. You have to have the information to upload it through the electronic system. So if you're making a disbursement...
So what you're saying is the reporting itself is very quick with the electronic system.
That's what I'm saying.
That's fine. But he's complaining about the time it takes to find the information that has to go into the report through his media buyers and so on, right?
I would offer that there's nothing in the record about media buyers or how long it takes to find information about media buyers. And I would refer the court to the information that must be provided under WSSTAT 11.06 sub 1. Regarding disbursements exceeding $20 in value, under 11.06 sub 1 sub G, must provide an itemized statement of every disbursement exceeding $20 in amount or value, together with the name and address of the person to whom the disbursement was made and the date and specific purpose for which the disbursement was made. That is the information that is required.
The PAC status designation under the Wisconsin regulatory scheme is not bifurcated. If you're in by virtue of these series of interlocking definitions in the statute and the rules, you're in 100%. You've got to comply with regulations, including contribution limits.
Well, Mr. Bopp misstated sort of what one of the claims that's at issue in this case. So in the district court level, the contribution limitation as to corporate limitations on spending, and then the $500 limit on solicitations for a corporation's separate PAC. With regard to the 11.38 limitation on expenditures, appeal that.
Right, that's the ban. That's the ban that's unconstitutional. So to the extent that the Wisconsin Elections Code prohibits corporations from spending money on political speech, that's unconstitutional.
Correct.
And the district court enjoined it. I get that.
Yes. District court enjoined.
I'm talking about if an organization like Wisconsin Right to Life or the Sierra Club or any other advocacy organization, not its PAC, but the organization itself is deemed a PAC to the extent that they want to spend over the de minimis dollar threshold on political speech, they are subject to the entire set of regulations, not just registration and reporting. So it's not just the more minimal disclosure requirements that were upheld in Citizens United, as I understand it, under the lower standard of scrutiny, but it's the whole set of full-blown TAG requirements, including limitations on the amount of contributions it can accept from individual donors. Is that right?
Correct. But here, Judge Sykes, I need to remind you that we're talking about two organizations that both are asserting that they're independent. So they would not be subject to contribution limits under this court's decision in Barland.
Right. I understand that. So aggregate limits. But are they subject to no spending limits either?
Correct.
So no spending limits, no aggregate contribution limits, but individual contribution limits?
My understanding is that under Barland, if Wisconsin Right to Life and its PAC are independent, they can receive unlimited contributions under Barland.
The statute that was challenged in the earlier phase of this litigation was the aggregate contribution.
Right.
I'm trying to get at the specific individual contribution limits that apply to accepting contributions. Any campaign committee, whether it's a candidate campaign committee or a PAC in Wisconsin, is limited in the amount of contributions it can accept from an individual contributor, not the aggregate that a contributor can make in the course of a single year. That was what was at issue earlier.
That is not what's at issue in this case. What's at issue is whether Wisconsin law must have a major purpose requirement.
Right, and that depends on whether this is a full-blown set of PAC burdens or something less than that.
And
that's what Buckley distinguishes,
right.
That's what Citizens United distinguishes. That's why I'm asking the question.
Right. Our position is that what's at issue in this case are the registration, reporting, and disclosure requirements, not the other contribution limits. That is our position. Those are the claims that are raised in this case.
I don't know that you're in a position to construe the scope of the claim here. If the claim is that Wisconsin Right to Life is being forced to register and report as if it were a PAC, mm-hmm. It's also subject to all of the other requirements that PACs are required to comply with, unless there's some exemption that nobody has mentioned here. Is there an exemption?
You mentioned one exemption, and I'll point out another. You mentioned the exemption in 11.06 sub 2, which, Judge Sykes, you characterize it as trying to create some kind of major purpose test. There's actually another exemption in GAB 1.28 sub 1A, I believe it's the definition of political committee, which has very similar language regarding, I think it's similar to the 11.06 sub 2 language. We would argue, though, that there is no requirement under the Constitution, under Buckley, to have any major purpose language in the statute or the regulation. And this Court has already held just that in Madigan.
Only to the extent that all that's at stake in the regulatory code are disclosure requirements. You've just told me that that's not the only thing that's at stake here. There are contribution limits.
I believe that the contribution limits are not at issue in this case for two reasons. First of all, count two of the first amended verified complaint, the district court enjoined that limitation, which is the corporate speech ban in Wisconsin law with stat 11.38. And we did not appeal that.
Okay, let me ask you this. If Wisconsin Right to Life has to register and report, can it accept unlimited contributions from any contributor?
Is it considered, and this is, you'd have to assume that the factual finding is that Wisconsin Right to Life is an independent
organization. I'm asking you what the code requires.
As long as Wisconsin Right to Life is independent of any candidate or candidate's committee,
right.
The answer is yes, it does not have to, it is not subject to those limitations on what it can receive.
And where does it say that in the statutes?
It doesn't. It stems from this Court's decision in Barland.
But Barland was an aggregate, involved the provision in
right.
the code that dealt with the aggregate annual contributions that individuals can make to independent expenditure organizations, not the specific donation caps.
I think the best I can tell you is that the position we've taken in this case with regard to counts 2 and 8 of the First Amendment Verified Complaint, which count 8 deals with the $500 solicitation limit, We've said that as applied to these two organizations, that the Government Accountability Board will not enforce it in light of Barlin.
As a litigating position.
Correct.
That gives very little comfort to any other independent speakers in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, independent speakers should be aware of the Barlin decision as well, though.
And that, again, deals with the aggregate annual limit. Because that was the only thing that was at stake the last time the case was here.
That's correct.
We left everything else for the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision in American Prosperity. That didn't go anywhere, so we're back.
Right, and I guess my position, Judge Sykes, is that the only two limitations that you're speaking of that are at issue are in counts 2 and 8 of the complaint. And count 2, we've established the district court has ruled in the plaintiff's favor. We have not appealed. And count 8, we've conceded that we will not enforce that limitation as to these
parties. Has the board said that?
That's our position we've taken
in
this case.
Has the board said that?
I don't. Well, the board is saying it through us. That's what I can say.
Those are two different things. Has the board said that? Adopted as a policy position that we're no longer going to enforce this part of the code?
The board has not promulgated any rule to that effect.
Does it have a policy? Has it addressed this in an open meeting? Said we recognize what's going on in federal court over there, and we're not going to enforce this.
Well, wait. Who does the enforcement?
The Government Accountability Board has enforcement responsibilities, as do district attorneys, and there are even opportunities in some circumstances for private individuals to.
I thought you were suggesting that the Attorney General of Wisconsin has decided not to enforce it.
In our brief, what we talk about there with regard to the Attorney General has come out with regard to the influencing language that's in Wisconsin law, and immediately after Buckley issued an Attorney General opinion that says that, consistent with Buckley, we would limit the influencing language.
Do such opinions govern? Do they govern these boards?
They do not govern the boards. And I think what you might be getting to, Judge Posner, has to do with sort of what's stated in this court's opinion, Wisconsin Right to Life versus Paradise. In that case, I believe this court held that there was an Attorney General opinion and then some opinions from the Government Accountability Board, which was called the Elections Board at the time, that made it clear that the provisions at issue in that case could not be applied to that entity. Here, what I think Judge Sykes is getting at is her concern that that the Government Accountability Board has not taken as aggressive, clear, express position as in the Paradise case.
What effect would this have on whether there should be a preliminary injunction as to Count 8?
As to Count 8, I guess we would argue that there's no threat of harm because we've taken the position that the Government Accountability Board will not be enforcing the statute as to Wisconsin Right to Life and its PAC. The court discussed the disclosure requirements, and as I stated with regard to the 24-hour reporting, that can be done electronically. With regard to the oath for independent disbursements, our position is that that oath is very important in that it provides useful information to the public regarding who is making speech about a speaker independently. So in Barlin, this court held that independent speakers like Wordle PAC can receive unlimited contributions. And that being the case, our position is that they should still be required to confirm in writing in a notarized statement that the speech they're engaging in is truly independent. With regard to the remaining...
GAB's regulation, it goes beyond the statutory requirements for that non-coordination oath and creates a presumption, as I suggested in my question to your opponent, that any expenditure is a contribution if it's unaccompanied by the oath. And that, it seems to me, puts the burden of risk of error on the speaker. And how is that constitutional?
Well, we would say that it's not unconstitutionally burdensome to have to confirm in writing that the speech you're engaging in is truly independent. This allows the public to evaluate the merits of that speech, whether they want to believe it or not believe it.
But as I've just suggested, the Government Accountability Board has gone beyond what the statute requires. The oath requirement seems to me not objectionable on its face, but the board has gone beyond that and created this presumption. Now, there's a question about whether that's ultra vires and all kinds of other issues here about what the board's authority is in the context of this particular regulation and some of the others that issue in this litigation. But let's assume it had the authority to do this. How is it constitutional if it creates this presumption which puts the risk of mistake on the speaker?
Well, I would argue a couple things in response. First of all, there's no claim in this case that, I think you're talking about GAB 1.28 sub 3 sub B. Is that correct, Judge Sykes? So you're talking about the...
It's, I think, 421.
Okay.
No expenditure may be made or obligation incurred over $25 in support of or opposition to a specific candidate unless the expenditure or obligation is treated and reported as a contribution.
Correct.
Or is made or incurred through an individual committee filing a voluntary oath. So if you make the mistake in classifying yourself as a speaker not required to register, then anything you spend is presumed to be a contribution, as I read this. And
right.
Is that an incorrect reading?
No, that is correct. And our position would be that what gives rise to these requirements of the entity determining when it must complete the oath, our position is that it's not unconstitutionally vague, that it is clear enough to allow an organization.
I'm not talking about vagueness. I'm talking about just substantive compliance with the requirements of the First Amendment. It's a significant burden.
Significant.
The oath itself alone is not, but this presumption where anything you spend is treated as a contribution, the board will treat it as a contribution, and presumably DAs enforcing these provisions around the state will treat it as a contribution and therefore charge you with violating Chapter 11 of the Wisconsin statutes and charge the candidate that you're speaking in favor of with accepting an unlawful contribution. How can that be constitutional?
I would argue that that's really not at issue. It's not a claim made in this case regarding GAB 1.42 sub 1. What they're challenging is the oath itself. They say that they don't have enough time to complete it. They don't have the staff to complete it. It takes 2, 5, 7 hours to complete it in some cases.
Okay. But it's an issue lurking under the surface here. That
could be. If the court has no further questions, I'd ask that the decisions of the district court be affirmed.
You made some arguments about mootness on the challenge to GAB 191.
Yes.
The emergency rule, which has since expired, but now a permanent rule that is identical in every respect, has arisen in its place. So how is that claim moot?
I would argue, Your Honor, that... And what you're referencing is the district court had determined of its own volition that that claim is moot because the place where the definition of organization in the rule changed from sub F to sub G.
What
I would
material
argue that,
difference does that make?
I would argue there is a material difference because if the court establishes a precedent that that is not moot, parties could just generically reference things without giving notice to other parties regarding what they're actually challenging.
It's the same exact regulation.
I would argue
it's just a different sub number. Why was the number changed, the numbering changed?
If you notice, in the old version, it was not in alphabetical order. In the new version, they now are in alphabetical order as far as the definitions.
So that was the only change of import. The substance of it is exactly the same.
Right.
So the challenge cannot possibly be moot.
I would
argue, now a permanent rule where there was an emergency rule, and it has F assigned to it instead of G, or the other way around. I can't remember.
Our position is the same position as the district court took. If they want to challenge G, they need to assert that in their complaint. They asserted that F is unconstitutional. And it needs to be clear. I think that Mr. Bopp's brief points out that if they had simply said GAB 1.91, that would be a different case. But they specifically said F.
And they cited the text of the regulation. So you are not laboring under a misapprehension about what's being challenged here. There's no surprise. There's no lack of notice. There's no unfair prejudice.
That I'm not sure if they cited the language of the definition of organization. I think
thanks. That's enough. Okay, thank you, Mr. Gorski. So, Mr. Bopp, your time had expired, but we'll give you another minute if you have anything.
I have nothing further.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, then, to both counsel.